Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us once again as we continue to pour through the big old monster box of baseball cards. And we are starting to get knee-deep in 1988. I'm figuratively saying knee-deep. Of course, some collectors are literally knee-deep in baseball cards from 1988. There were so many of them. And this time we talk about the poster child of the overabundance of baseball cards, 1988 Donruss. And it's a set that I honestly feel it gets a bad rap because, as we'll discuss, it's not a terrible set. It's memorable for many reasons, but because there were so many of them over the last 25 plus years, it just seems like everybody has them somewhere and they can't get rid of them. We'll also talk about our random pull, which is Jay Bell, the legendary shortstop. And I say legendary tongue in cheek because he had a pretty remarkable career, but it kind of gets overshadowed by a lot of quality middle infielders from the 80s and 90s. Card number 637 in the 88 Donruss set. Pictured there in his Cleveland Indians uniform the last season he would play in Cleveland, as he spent most of his career in Pittsburgh and hit it big with Arizona in 2001. So we'll talk about Jay Bell. We'll talk about 88 Donruss in just a few minutes. First, I like to talk about what you're talking about. We'll check the Twitter timeline here. At Wax and Gum Stains is our Twitter handle. Pass it along to your friends. And don't forget, as you're telling them about our Twitter feed, where you're always welcome to talk about not only our podcast, but anything related to the baseball card hobby, industry, whatever you want to call it. Make sure that you tell them that we are coming your way every Tuesday and Friday with a new edition of Wax Ecstatic. Now, we had a lot of commentary about our previous podcast on 88 Score, and that is a set that I said really is, it's unfortunate that it gets lumped into all of the other sets from 1988, because again, 1988 was kind of the benchmark of just way too many baseball cards being made, even though in reality, the hobby didn't completely explode until the early 90s, where you not only had six or seven major sets being designed, but you also had six or seven subsets to every set being designed. So even though things got out of hand in the 90s, 1988, for a lot of people, that's the benchmark. That was the year that everything went to hell in a handbasket. But for the 88 Score set, it's really not that fair. And I have to agree with something that one of our listeners, Booby Main, or Robbie T86, as his handle is. I've got to find out why they call you Booby. Or maybe I shouldn't. I don't know. Maybe that's a private conversation there. But anyways, he chimed in and said, "I'll argue all day long that 88 Score raised the quality bar higher than 89 Upper Deck did. And I'll be right." Well, of course, that's up for debate, but I agree with you because, as I mentioned in the podcast, 88 Score had outstanding photo quality throughout the entire set. And even though Topps, Fleer, and Donruss had very good photography throughout the years, certainly the bar was raised there by Score. You had a very colorful design. You had a very sharp design. And especially on the backs of the cards, as we mentioned, you not only had full-color photos of the players on the back, but you also just had this incredible litany of information, be it stats or that scouting report, if you will, in the bottom half of the card there. So everyone gives credit to Upper Deck for raising the bar, and rightly so, in the sense that really once Upper Deck came on, the industry was not the same. Everybody was playing catch up with Upper Deck, and most everybody got there, I'd say, by 92, 93. But everybody remembers Upper Deck, and I think it's because those Upper Deck packs, if I remember, were $1 a piece back in the day, which was ridiculous. How old was I when that came out? I was 12 or 13 years old. Man, $1 was a lot of money. I mean, I couldn't part with that. I didn't mow enough yards to get enough dollar bills to go buy the Upper Deck packs. So I ended up buying the Score packs, and I think they were still 50 cents like much of the other packs around back then. Actually, a lot of the packs back then were, see, in 88, they were 40 cents in a lot of cases. I know Donruss and Topps was 40 cents. Fleer might have been 45. But anyways, Upper Deck, you know, you were paying twice as much for those cards. But people remember that set. It kind of really broke the mold, although Score kind of set it. So I agree with you, Robbie. 88 Score does not quite get the credit that it should. simply because it just gets lost in the shadow of the 89 Upper Deck set. Let's see, Ben Adams with a couple of comments this week. He says, I never liked that set. Could have been how bright the colors were or that it was all different colors. And that could be a little disorienting. You know, you had the various colors, as I mentioned, every 110 cards in that 660 card set was a different color. The first 110 were purple, and then you had red, you had dark blue, you had green, you had gold, you know, the Michael Avaier card that we were looking at, that was part of that green part of the set. And I can completely understand why some people would never really care for it, because you were so used to one uniform set and not exactly the full rainbow collection here, if you will. Alex Hyde chiming in on that. To this day, I still refer to this as the Easter egg set. Never thought of it that way, but I can clearly see why. Although, you know, Easter eggs are more pastels. You know, you kind of get the light colors, unless, you know, mom and dad mixed up the dyes wrong, and then you get that funky kind of brown color that you dye the eggs in. So I wouldn't call it the Easter egg set. I would call it, however, the Skittle set. There is definitely a chance to taste the rainbow with the color combinations in 88 score. Hearing from our friends at Baseball Card Backs, I knew that you would like my commentary on the backs of 88 score, and we get the copy of Tim Raines' card from that set, card number 3, talking about the comments of Chuck Tanner, then the Braves manager. A lot of people forget that Bobby Cox was not always the Braves manager. It seems that way, but Chuck Tanner was the Braves manager in 1987, and part of that big old scouting report was at the bottom, and I quote, Tim Raines is not a good player. He's a great one. He's the best leadoff hitter who's ever been in the game. That's something you did not see on the backs of other cards, because the space was extremely limited for either a trivia tidbit or a very small fact about the player, or there were just too many stats and they didn't have room really for any commentary there. So thank you, Baseball Card Backs, for sharing that once again. Let's see, Sports Carter. I like early score now, but as a kid in 88, I never bought score packs over Topps, Donruss, and Fleer. Of course, that was part of the big issue for any newcomer, was that if your product was somewhat similar, although we pretty much agree that Score was a slight notch over the other card companies in 1988 in terms of quality, you're still the new kid on the block. You still have to establish a fan base there. And I think something that didn't help 88 score was 89 score was really a lackluster set. My least favorite set. In fact, I was rummaging through the cards to try to find, some of 89 score, because I didn't think I had any anymore. I probably just gave them away years ago. Was able to find one. We'll share that at the 89 score podcast in a few weeks. But, part of the problem is that you're entering a field with three heavyweights, certainly Topps a big heavyweight, and Fleer and Donruss by that time. This was their eighth edition of cards that was coming out. So you've got edition number 1, you're going up against 2 edition number 8s, and then in Topps, let me see, in 1988 it would have been what, edition number 43, something like that. They were there for decades while Score was just brand new. So obviously in 1988, it might have been a little harder for some people to find, just because you didn't really relate to it. You didn't know what to say about 88 score. Let's see, RJ talking about 88 score. I have the 91 set, lots of similar shots, bats hitting balls. Yeah, the photography is very much the same. In fact, Score did have very good photography throughout their run, even if the designs weren't really up to snuff, in my opinion. Of course, the similarity between 88 score and 91 score is that 91 score also alternated colors, although more in a 1991 style, I have to say, as they had kind of that, let's see, one, they had a teal color, they had a dark blue, they had black, they had white. You know, we've mentioned before that Topps went out of their way to design their cards to kind of speak for the year, and 1991 score certainly did that. There were a lot of 1991 colors in that set, especially on the outside border there. Let's see, MJR Sports chiming in, always looking for good baseball card podcasts. Right now I'm listening to Beckett Radio and Wax and Gum Stains. Of course, that's us. Anybody got others? I'm curious if you have others. And thank you, MJR, for sharing Beckett Radio. I wasn't aware of them. I don't have a whole lot of time to listen to podcasts, but I'm definitely going to check them out. And I mentioned this in my previous note two podcasts ago. One that I do check out on a regular basis is Tops Talk with Alex Birch. That is the Tops Company's official podcast. Granted, it's a little more of a marketing podcast. I mean, they need to talk about sets that are coming out and they need to promote items that they have up for sale. But I think Alex does a great job of working in some of the promotional messaging with just stories about players, about collectors, about the hobby in general. So check out Topps Talk. That comes out, I think, every other week. They kind of slow things down when baseball season's done. But definitely a good listen if you want to go back. And you can listen to their podcast on Audio Boom, much like ours. And it's good to listen to some of their previous episodes, too, because some of them are timeless and very, very entertaining. One last comment about the 88 set from David Armour. Greg Jeffries was the hottest card in that set that year. Everyone was trying to pull his card from his packs. Yeah, remember Greg Jeffries? That was the stud rookie in 1988. How silly were we? it happens every year. We've talked to death about Ron Kittle in 1983 when he had Sandberg, Gwynn, and Boggs in all those sets. But remember to 1991, Todd Van Poppel. That's another one. Todd Van Poppel was one. You can think of every set. There's somebody in every set that was just the big rookie. This is the guy. And maybe he had a good year or two. But Greg Jeffries certainly petered out by the time the 1989 season was around. I remember 89 Tops having a Future Stars card. He had kind of this, I don't want to call it Star Wars because I don't think it was that good. It was kind of a Buck Rogers in the 25th century or whatever it was. The Buck Rogers, spaceman font at the top. And Future Star, Greg Jeffries, wow! And, he didn't quite pan out as well as Topps would have liked him to. So, Jeffries was one of them. Joe Charbonneau, that's another one from the early 80s there. Every set, every year has that one guy that everybody thinks can't miss, and he does. Most of them were rated rookies in Donruss. But I digress. Hey, speaking of Donruss, let's take a look at our card, the 88 Donruss set, the redheaded stepchild of card collecting, because it just came out at the wrong time and there's just too much of it. Again, our random pull is J. Bell, card number 637. We'll talk about J. Bell in just a little bit, but let's look at the 88 Donruss card. Now, what's funny about 88 Donruss is it does get a bad rap just because there's so much that was made in 1988. There's still so much out there now. It is definitely not a set that you're going to get rich off of. In fact, this is one of those hindrance sets, much like 89 Score was. If you got too much 88 Donruss, you may even toss them in the trash, which is hard for a collector to do. But sometimes when you're tired of lugging around boxes and boxes of these cards, you'll just find any excuse just to get rid of them. And it's unfortunate because I think 88 Donruss has a lot to it. I remember when I was a kid, and remember I started collecting in 89, so 88 Donruss was still very much available on the market in card shops and even retail stores. If they didn't clear the shelves quick enough, you could find them in a bargain bin. 88 Donruss, I always liked the design. And when you look at the front of the card, in fact, if you're looking at the J. Bell card here, you've got the blue, primarily blue border, that is, except for two corners of the border, where you have this rather disco dance floor black and red kind of square thingy. In fact, I've done this before. If you line up a bunch of 88 Donruss cards, you can actually kind of create this bizarre kaleidoscope effect with the background. If you try to line up the squares that are in the corners, if you do that too, you may have too much time in your hands. You may want to get outside and get some fresh air. But I actually like that design, even though it was definitely not cutting edge. Like I said, it was kind of disco dance floor. So you're dealing with, a design that may have been cutting edge in 1978 on a product that was released in 1988. But there was still something cool about it. Maybe it was that blue color. The word cool, the feeling cool is associated with the color blue. And maybe that's just what works. Maybe that's just what makes it cool. Maybe not cool again and trendy cool, but just has that feeling to it. It's just a nice card. And you've got that border. You've got the picture of prominently featured right smack dab in the middle of the card. In fact, once you get past the obnoxious border, you've got a pretty clean card there. The Donruss logo up in the upper left-hand corner, lower right-hand corner, team logo. Of course, I love that. You've got old smiling Chief Wahoo here. This was just before the movie Major League was released, so those Indian cards really stood out back then because the Indians truly were a horrible team. And the butt of jokes, of course, a big of a butt of jokes to have that movie made after them. And then at the bottom, you've got on a red bar the player's name and position, and that's it. Flip the card over. Very standard Donruss stuff in the late 1980s there, where you've got the same blue color, that cool blue color, kind of that cool mint color, if you will. Very similar to the 86 Donruss, actually. The only difference is you've got that black bar that kind of runs across the top of the stats bar. But you've got the card number and the baseball in the upper left-hand corner, player's name, and personal stats right beneath it. The recent major league performance, so again, up to the last 5 years. You've got some personal information like how he was acquired, and then you've got some career highlights, little tidbits that the people at Donruss would scribble down there in the bottom. And in fact, there is one on there that we're going to talk about with Jay Bell in just a little bit, and that is he became the 55th player in history and only the second Cleveland Indian to hit a home run in his first major league at-bat. And the interesting thing is, the guy that he hit it off of, Burt Blyleven, who we've talked about on this podcast before, and yes, he's a Hall of Famer. Burt Blyleven was traded for Jay Bell before Jay made his major league career debut. So we'll have plenty to talk about with that. But a neat little factoid from Donruss, not quite up to the status of what we saw on the backs of scorecards, but still a very nice card, a very nice set. And again, it's a card set that just gets knocked around way too much because there's way too much of it. There's just floods of Donruss cards and, you know, collectors, because back in the late 80s, you know, let's remember where we were back then. I touched on this during the Score podcast. You had three companies in 1981. That's after Topps owned the market ever since 1956. So you had three companies in 1981, the Players Association looking for more revenue streams. So they started licensing more and more companies to do baseball cards. So all of a sudden, the hobby is just blowing up massively by 1988. So not only did you have more companies coming in, but you just had massive production overload by all companies, even Upper Deck, as we would find out later. Anybody who hoarded those Ken Griffey Jr. cards, card number one, thinking that you were going to pay off those student debts or send your kid to law school, you learn the hard way that even though there is still value in that card, it is certainly not tens of thousands of dollars like we all thought it would be back in the late 80s and early 90s. So the 88 Donruss set gets knocked around because there's just so much of it. In fact, go onto Google, go onto eBay, just do a search, 88 Donruss box, set, packs, whatever. You can get, and this is not including shipping and handling, but you can get a complete box of 88 Donruss packs for $10. And that is kind of the low bar in terms of, you know, online sales, at least from what I've seen in what's out there. I mean, even 88 Tops, you know, $12 or $13, but 88 Donruss is just dirt cheap. The sets sell for, you know, $15 to $20. You also have, you know, wax packs, rack packs, cello packs. There just is so much stuff out there. You can get it very, very cheap. Now, we should say not every card is worth 6 cents. I mean, quite a few of them are. But you do have some star cards. Of course, young guys like Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire. Ken Caminiti had a rookie card in this set. Tom Glavine, Roberto Alomar, rookie cards in this set. You know, they're priced at about a couple of dollars ungraded, so it's not like they're completely worthless, but if you're buying 88 Donruss, it's because you've got too much money to throw around or you're uninformed. But I will say this, it is a nice set. It looks nice. And hey, if you want to put together a set that's real cheap and you probably will never have stolen from your collection because nobody is actively seeking for 88 Donruss sets to thieve from your closet, might be the set that you want to collect. Might not be. You might be like most everybody else, and you kept the valuable cars, and the others either got sold at a garage sale, sold at a card shop that buys those cards cheap for collectors to fill out their sets, or, like I said, may have ended up in a trash can at some point in time. Would not surprise me one bit. But like I said, even though it's a card set that's not going to set you back, and you certainly don't need to turn over rocks to try to find it, it's everywhere. If you're interested in collecting a nice looking set that's got some decent players in it, then 88 Donruss is not a bad option. But don't buy it for value. And what I mean by value is you're going to make any money off of it. Forget it. You're actually probably going to lose money trying to assemble some of these sets here. But if you're just somebody that's got to stack up cards and try to create sets, complete sets from the late 1980s, and 88 Donruss is on your list, trust me, you could do worse. Because, again, design, I actually like the design. It's a good design, but because there's so much of it, 88 Donruss just gets beaten up like madness. All right, now let's take a look at our random pull. Card number 637, Jay Bell. This was one of those cards, when I pulled it out of the stack of 88 Donruss I have, I said, wow, Jay Bell. And you kind of remember, this guy was not a bad baseball player. The downside for Jay Bell is that he was a very good shortstop and second baseman in a time when there were a lot of very good shortstops and second basemen, some with a little more notoriety than him. Of course, you had guys like Cal Ripken Jr., you had Ozzie Smith, you had Trammell Whitaker in Detroit, you had Roberto Alomar, you had, you name it. I mean, there were so many quality shortstops and second basemen in the late 80s and early 90s that a guy like Jay Bell, who was not spectacular, but serviceable and pretty dependable throughout his career, he gets totally lost in the shuffle. And that's unfortunate. So it's kind of neat that we pulled Jay Bell here, because we get to talk about some of the cool things about his career. First of all, he was originally drafted by the Minnesota Twins. A lot of people don't know this. He was drafted in the first round of the 1984 draft. And then he was traded by the Twins on August 1st, 1985 for the ever popular player to be named later. That would turn out to be pitcher Rich Yett. Y-E-T-T, one of my favorite baseball names from the 80s. Hi, are you Rich Yett? No, but my agent's working on a contract. Boom, ping. You know, it's kind of a bad joke. Yeah, actually, it's a very bad joke. Not even good enough for vaudeville. But that's why I kind of like that name. Hey, it's Rich Yett. No, I'm still waiting for that paycheck to come in. Anyways, Rich Yett comes in to the deal. Also, Kurt Wardle, Jim Weaver go to Cleveland. Boy, the Indians were making stellar deals back then. Bert Blyleven, the old Dutchman, goes to Minnesota. And as I mentioned, the two big names in that trade, as it would turn out, Jay Bell and Bert Blyleven, would actually square off against one another in 1986 when Bell was making his major league debut. So he makes his major league debut, gets a call up very late in the 86 season. Let me get the exact date here. It was September 29th, 1986. And several years ago, Deadspin did a great story about, you know, when a player knows that his pro career is ended. And they talked to Jay Bell. And Jay mentioned that he was at the time playing for the Indians rookie ball club. They were in Sarasota, Florida. He gets the call up. So he's riding in a car with Mike Hargrove, of course, future Cleveland Indians manager, amongst other teams. Hargrove was the manager of the team there in Sarasota. He's driving up to Tampa so that Bell can get on a plane and head north to take on the Twins. And that game was in Cleveland, by the way. So while they're driving up there, Hargrove is talking about Blyleven. Of course, they were teammates with the Indians back in the early 80s. And Hargrove is telling him, hey, swing at the first pitch, because Blylevin's going to throw you a fastball first pitch. And besides, you can't hit his curveball. So Bell takes that mental note. He steps up to the plate. Blylevin is perfect in the first 2 2/3 innings of the game. First pitch, Bell hits it over the fence. Welcome to the major leagues. As the 88 Donruss card mentions, the 55th player in major league history at that time, and only the second in Cleveland history to hit a home run on his first at bat. And ironically, against the guy he was traded for about a year and a half earlier. That's spectacular. Now, Bell would go on to tell the story that in his second at bat, Blyleven struck him out on three straight pitches. And then in his third at bat of the game, Bell worked Blyleven, I think, to 11 pitches and then ended up striking out. But when Bell's heading back to the dugout, Lyleven actually tipped his cap to him, which is really cool. So that's the very unique start that Jay Bell had to his major league career in 1986. He would hang around with the Indians through the 1988 season, but then he was on his way to Pittsburgh, where a lot of people remember him. March 25th, 1989, right before the 89 season started, Bell goes to Pittsburgh to complete an earlier deal made, going back to November of 88. So Bell was the player to be named later, which is interesting because Bell was sent to Pittsburgh for a guy named Denny Gonzalez. Does that ring a bell? No pun intended. No, it probably shouldn't, because Denny Gonzalez just does not really matter in the major leagues after this point in time. In fact, he played a whopping 8 games with the Cleveland Indians in 1989. So I think it's safe to say the Pittsburgh Pirates won that trade, as Bell would go on to be an all-star shortstop, a Gold Glove winning shortstop. In fact, when he won the Gold Glove in 1993, it ended a 13-year stretch of Ozzie Smith winning the National League Gold Glove at that position. So that's quite an honor there. He was also a Silver Slugger in 93. One of his two All-Star appearances happened in 93, the other one in 99 with Arizona. And he was also, believe it or not, in MVP talk back in the early 90s. Now, he wasn't top five, but he was top 20 vote-getter in MVP. So again, this guy was not as flashy as some of the bigger stars in the major leagues back then, but he got enough attention to where people at least penciled him in, believe it or not, in the MVP race. Now, as I mentioned, he was a good, not spectacular shortstop. In fact, one of the reasons why the Twins may have moved him in that deal for Burt Blyleven is when he was in the minor leagues, he was just throwing balls away left and right. He made a lot of errors in his 3 years in the minor leagues, but he was certainly able to straighten that out as he worked his way up through the major leagues, mostly with Pittsburgh. Now, in 15 seasons at shortstop, and this will extend on to Kansas City and Arizona, which I'll get to in just a little bit, but he had a career fielding percentage of .975. Again, for a shortstop, not great, but good enough. You know, and he was actually a little better at second base as his career changed at Arizona. Now, before he got to Arizona, he went to Kansas City as he was part of a trade between two teams that were just hitting rock bottom for a very long stretch. The Pirates trading Bell and Jeff King to the Royals for Jeff Martin, who never made it out of the minor leagues, Jeff Granger, Jeff Wallace, and Joe Randa. Now, Randa had a pretty lengthy career as a third baseman. So Bell would play the entire 97 season in Kansas City, and it was the first time that he hit over 20 home runs, 21 home runs in 153 games, .291 batting average. Now, as a batter, he was pretty good throughout his time in Pittsburgh, averaged around .265, I'd say, but he was able to start hitting the cover off the ball a little more, starting in Kansas City and certainly in Arizona. Now, in that same article at Deadspin.com that I was talking about earlier, Bell attributes his increased offensive production to some style tips that Chili Davis, the veteran outfielder, gave him in Kansas City. Of course, some people don't necessarily believe that. It's 1997, after all. We know what era in baseball is going on at this time. And what really raised eyebrows just a couple of years later in Arizona was his 38 home run season. That's right, 38 home runs, 112 RBI, a .289 batting average in 1999, his second All-Star season with Arizona. Now, he talked about the suspicions because, you know, Matt Williams was suspected of PED use. Luis Gonzalez was also suspected. Certainly Curt Schilling was suspected. There were a lot of people suspected of using steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs back then. Now, Bell did not necessarily deny those accusations, certainly didn't say, yeah, guess what, I was juicing. He just acknowledges that he was caught up in a lot of the scuttlebutt going on back then, that anybody who suddenly had this offensive surge had to be juicing. And, well, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. Jay Bell is never going to tell us. He just kind of says, hey, I understand people got thrown under the bus, and I did too. And that's about it. So take it for what it's worth. 38 home runs in 1999. Bell will attribute it not only to his hitting style changes in Kansas City a couple years ago, or a couple years before, I should say, but also to being on a team with some very good players. And hey, you know, the Diamondbacks as an expansion team in 98, and Bell was an original member of the Diamondbacks. He signed as a free agent in the fall of 1997. He did have some pretty good players. That was a very well-constructed team, of course, winning the World Series in 2001. Now, another interesting tidbit about that World Series and Jay Bell. If I ask you who hit the game-winning, series-winning hit in Game 7 against the Yankees in 2001, show of hands, most of you know Luis Gonzalez, right? Well, it was Luis Gonzalez, but also it was Jay Bell who was on third base, who came home to score the winning run in Game 7. And that was something that he said was really a career highlight. He never really understood how special his career was to family and friends and fans until that moment. And what he also admits to is that, and I'd have to look back at the video of this. I don't recall every single pitch that happened in Game 7 of the 0-1 series, but he said he nearly screwed up a bunt that started off that inning. He was a very good bunter in his career. Nearly screwed it up, so he almost didn't get on base to begin with. And lo and behold, in the end, turns out he's scoring the winning run as Luis Gonzalez was able to knock him in. Now, he would stay with the Diamondbacks for one more year, and rather interestingly, his numbers tailed off offensively. What do you know? In 2002, he appeared in just 32 games, hit a whopping 163. Of course, he'll tell you, well, you know, I was getting platooned. I was 36 years old. That's part of it, certainly. So he becomes a free agent in 2002, goes to the New York Mets in 2003, and that is where he wraps up his career, appearing in just 72 games, hitting 181 and zero home runs. But the final numbers on Jay Bell's career, 2,063 games, a career batting average of 265, and also 195 home runs, nearly 20% of them coming in the 1999 season. Imagine that. Also, the fielding numbers, as I mentioned, as a shortstop, 975 fielding percentage. He was shifted over to second base while at Arizona in 1999. He had 979 fielding percentage. So again, not Hall of Fame worthy, but certainly was up to taking care of business when he got out in the field. And he had a very lengthy career because of that, even though I'm joking about home run totals. 18 seasons in the big leagues, and quite a few of them with not good teams. You know, the Indians in the mid-80s, the Pirates in the mid-90s, the Royals in 1997. You know, he was part of some good teams in Pittsburgh in the early 90s, and certainly a world champion in 2001. But for a guy who was with some really good teams and some really bad teams, he was a very consistent player. Now, what has happened to Jay Bell ever since then? Well, he retired after the 2003 season, spent a little time with his family, and got into coaching. In fact, he was the hitting coach for the Pirates back in the 2013 season, later named the bench coach in Cincinnati in the 2014 and 15 seasons, and he is also a member of the advisory board of the Baseball Assistance Team. That is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping former Major League, Minor League, and Negro League players through financial and medical difficulties, and that is outstanding. A lot of people don't realize, because, you know, we get so lost in the numbers of contracts these days, that a lot of former players, and it's not just in baseball, I know for a fact hockey hurts, certainly in football, and I'm sure basketball is up there as well. A lot of players who played prior to the big contract days, which for many sports started in the 1970s or early 1980s, some of them are destitute. And it's really cool to see Jay Bell as part of the team for Baseball Assistance Team to help those who are a little less fortunate, who were not as fortunate as he was, to make the kind of money that he did. And Jay Bell made some very good money. In fact, the Diamondbacks, the last two seasons that he played for them, he made over $8 million. Now, that doesn't sound too bad for a second baseman or shortstop today, but again, 15 years ago, that was pretty, certainly not the high bar mark. That wasn't Alex Rodriguez money. That wasn't Derek Jeter money, but still a pretty good paycheck. And even if you go back to his days in Pittsburgh, he was still making anywhere between $3 and $5 million a year. So, you know, for a guy who made a pretty good living, being a pretty good ball player for a long time, it's nice to see him giving back to other players. So there you go, Jay Bell, our random pull from the 1988 Donruss set, a set that, again, just You know what? It gets lumped into all the bad sets. And while in terms of value, and again, it's a set that if you have too many of them, you probably feel burdened by them, it's still a nice looking set. Let me put it to you this way. It should not get the rap that it does simply because there's too many of them. It is a good looking set, but unfortunately there are too many of them, so a lot of people overlook it. J. Stuart Bell, as the back of Donruss card number 637 says, our random pull for this episode. All right, what do you think about 88 Donruss, the hobby in 1988, the story of J. Bell, or anything about the collecting hobby? Let me know. You can reach out at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter at any point in time. I'll be happy to answer your questions, comments, thoughts, memories, whatever the case is. And make sure you join us on Friday as we do another deep dive into the Monster Box. We'll be looking at 88 Fleer, a little departure from the strictly business sets that Fleer put out in the mid-1980s. In fact, you could say Fleer went on a bender in 88. But what company in the hobby didn't do that back then? We'll talk about it on Friday. I'm your host, Matt Sam, and thanks for tuning into another edition of Wax Ecstatic.